If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Welcome to the podcast for issue 47 of Ruler Magazine. My name's Jack Thurston, and we're recording this issue at the new palatial headquarters of RAFA. They were kind enough to give us a little meeting room here, and with me round the table are Michael Brecken, member of the Yorkshire, what was it, Michael?
Yorkshire Road Club.
The Yorkshire Road Club. Now, Michael is also a former manager of the Canadian national cycling team, a cycle racer himself, and also a journalist. You dabble in film, been in Hollywood, all kinds of things. We're going to hear a little bit more about that later in the podcast. And also Richard Moore, a former star bike racer in the 1990s.
That's a huge exaggeration, Jack.
Well, it's the Commonwealth Games year. I've got to big you up. Now well known as a cycling journalist, author of books, and also podcaster with the Cycling
Arrival
podcast. A complimentary podcast, The Rival Mob. Yeah, okay, well, we're talking about the current issue, 47, which I think has got a kind of cinematic feel to it. Certainly the subscriber issue has these storyboard-like cartoons on the front. And let's dive in straight away with our choices of favourite photos from the magazine, photos or photo spreads. Mike?
I think page 20 captures everything that could be about the Tour de France in the UK. I think it was taken in the last visit. Was that 94?
No, 2007, this is. Oh, hang on, this picture?
I thought that was down in on the way to Canterbury.
Yeah, in 2007.
2007, right.
Yeah.
It demonstrates how universal the Tour's appeal is, because that's a kind of a typical Kentish middle-class town. But if you look at the faces on the side of the road, they're as animated and excited as anyone you see on Alpe d'Huez. And it just shows what an extraordinary event the Tour de France is.
Richard?
I think my favourite spread would have to be the accompanying this feature on Ottavio Bottecchia, one of the tragic Italian bike riders of the 1920s. Andy McGrath has tackled him in a long piece about Bottecchia, whose fascinating character won the Tour de France twice, first Italian to win the Tour, and tragically died while preparing for the Tour on a training ride. In mysterious circumstances, he was found by the side of the road. There were rumours that he'd been attacked by a farmer for stealing grapes. There were all sorts of conspiracy theories about what happened to him. He'd been knocked off by the mafia or the fascist supporters of Mussolini. There's a great mystery around his death. But some of the pictures, some of them are quite familiar. There's a great one of him taking his tire off his wheel with his teeth. And there are a couple of other... But there are a couple of pictures in there that I haven't seen before. And they're very evocative of that time. And, you know, you see some of these pictures of these old bike riders and think, you know, they look incredibly athletic and muscular, and you could imagine them prospering really in any era.
Yeah, it's a different look, isn't it, to the look of today?
It's a different look, but there are similarities. You know, the positions are different on the bikes are a little bit different, but you can see that that these guys were top athletes.
I'm going to choose a funny one, page 39. I think this is the 1994, judging by the era of this gentleman's trainers.
Velcro, are they?
Yeah, they're sort of, what are they? They look like they're Reeboks.
Good old Reeboks.
Yeah, Reeboks, blue and white Reeboks there. But what I quite like is this trio of guys who look like they've just, well, they look like they've just been doing some painting and decorating, then have gone down to the pub, and now are watching the Tour de France, and they're leaning out to get a better view in the road with their pints as a sort of counterweight to stop them actually tipping into the road. And then there's the chap here on the chair, sort of looking a bit professorial with his Birkenstocks and his shaggy hairdo and glasses. I do like the look of cycling crowds out on the street. They are kind of, it's a kind of heterogeneous look, isn't it? It's not like when you go to a football match and everyone kind of looks the same. You know, there's a lot of team colours. There's all sorts turn out to watch a bike race. Whether it's
that's always a danger if you put it on public roads, I guess. Well, get anyone turning up.
I think it's the virtue of the sport. Right, Mike, you have written a piece which is telling the story of the film that was never made about the Tour de France.
Yeah, well, it's one of a series that were never made, really. I mean, the whole kind of relationship between Hollywood and the Tour de France is really quite extraordinary. Since the early late 1960s, Hollywood has been sniffing around the Tour, and I think it's fair to say the Tour has been sniffing around Hollywood, but it's never ever actually come to pass. I'd heard in the early 70s about the visit of Dustin Hoffman to the 1969 Tour. And that kind of caught my interest. And that I've really been kind of an observer of the scene ever since, as far as I could find things out, just watching things happen. And yet here we are today, and there still really isn't a great dramatic movie about the Tour de France, or really, come to that, any bike race. A lot of people have tried.
But it wasn't just Dustin Hoffman going to have a recce, was it? They went out and actually shot quite a lot of footage.
They did. That came later, actually, in the 1980s. And the extraordinary Danish filmmaker, Jorgen Leth, who made that wonderful documentary, A Sunday in Hell, was finally hired by Universal Pictures to actually shoot some footage as a kind of a recce for what was going to be a film of a book called Yellow Jersey by a British writer called Ralph Hearn. But it just never happened. And then there's a huge story. I got totally lost on the internet for weeks trying to find out where the footage had gone and what had really happened to it. And the fact is, nobody actually really knows.
Well, I mean, this is a remarkable revelation for me in your story, is that there's an enormous quantity, and he's actually quite sad about it, isn't he? You describe him on the verge of tears, saying that there's all this amazing footage that is just gone. But it probably isn't gone. Do you think, with your knowledge of the film industry, do you think it is gone, or do you think it's just in a room somewhere?
I think it's probably in a room somewhere, but nobody knows where. I tried to make contact with Gary Melman, who'd been the producer who'd bought the rights to the book and had funded, got money out of Universal Pictures to try and do something. And the phone just rang out. Nobody answered. Contacts of mine in LA tried to find him. It's just nobody knows. Jorgen Leth, when I spoke to him, was literally in tears on the phone. There are 50 miles, allegedly, of film shot on that Tour de France in 1984. And it's just out there. Nobody knows where.
I think, am I right in thinking they appeared at a few tours in the mid-80s? Were they there in 86 as well?
There were a number of film crews there on a number of occasions. The big one was 84, where the Tour de France were really behind it. And Leth was shooting. Dustin Hoffman was there, as I tell in the article. Paul Sherwin, he passed Paul Sherwin on one of the climbs.
I knew Potter wasn't a great climber, but to be passed by Dustin Hoffman.
It's quite bizarre in the race director's
I know. But there is that picture of Dustin Hoffman with Greg LeMond at the 84 Tour. And I spoke to Jürgen Leff about this a couple of years ago as well, because I have a sort of interest in this, because there's just been a film made of my book Slaying the Badger about the 1986 Tour de France, the battle between Hinault and LeMond. And they've used a lot of archive footage for that, obviously. But they are aware that there's this treasure trove of lost footage that I'm sure would have added even more to it.
And it sounds like they got pretty good access, because the tour organisers were on board, so it wasn't a matter of like these days where there's a small camera crew trying to do what they can around the margins. You know, this was official.
They had complete clearance to do whatever they could. They even had a special Citroën car apparently set up with cameras, and one of the riders, the Australian guy whose name escapes me, actually had camera.
Anderson.
It was Phil, yeah. Phil had actually had camera on the bike at one point. So the tour laid itself open, and they were hoping that out of it would come a dramatic feature film.
They were also very seduced by America at the time. Felix Levitin was really looking at America as being a market to expand into. They set up a Tour of America. And even back then, there was talk of beginning the Tour de France in America one year.
Well, actually, it goes back even to the 70s. In 1972, believe it or not, I was involved with the Tour de la Nouvelle France, which was a deal with Levitin and the Tour de France in the province of Quebec in Canada, and that ran for 3 years. Mm. And that was, again, the tour trying to get a foothold in North America, but again, it didn't really work out.
Well, we could go into why that didn't work out, why the American start or whatever didn't work out, but let's stay on the subject of films. Why didn't this film not come to fruition, and why has there not been a really good feature film about this great bike race?
I think the problem lies that there are two kinds of films. There are, if you will, docudramas, and then there are feature films. And Rush, in effect, was a docudrama. And there was some special shooting done at Caldwell Park and other tracks to bring it all together. But it was pretty effectively done. But it was a real-life story. It was a story of the two great drivers of the time. But it needs, for a feature film, you need a great book. And maybe that's a cue for you to think about, Richard.
Well, I mean, there is forthcoming, and I saw a trailer the other night, actually, for the new Lance Armstrong film, feature film, starring Ben Foster, which is based on David Walsh's book, Seven Deadly Sins. And I've heard a couple of people who've seen sort of first cuts of it who are very complimentary about it. But I must say, based on the trailer, my expectations aren't very high. I think perhaps because that adjustment of seeing an actor playing Lance Armstrong is a difficult one to make when you are so familiar yourself with Armstrong. Perhaps over the course of a film, you grow comfortable with that, but I wasn't overly impressed with the sort of very short trailer. I mean, there have been a few documentaries recently. The Pantani one, obviously, which I think was disappointing. There were bits that really jarred in that. There was some excellent footage, but it didn't really work for me. Armstrong Lie, I thought, was pretty awful film. Two films in one, which I think you mentioned in the piece as well. The new Armstrong film, Stop at Nothing, is excellent. Really, really worth watching. But there is a spate of cycling films at the moment.
As you say, a number of good documentaries. Pour le Maillot Jaune is probably one of the best. And I actually used that to help sell the concept of the Tour de la Nouvelle France in the 70s. But it's just never really happened. I think it's probably very, very difficult to get actors to go through what a Tour de France rider has to.
Yeah, I mean, there's...
And to make it look real.
Maybe we should ask ourselves, what are the really successful sports films in general that we can look
fire.
At?
Chariots of Fire.
That's about it, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, are there many more?
Rocky was tremendously popular, wasn't it?
Yeah, but I guess if you're a boxing aficionado, you'd probably watch
Raging
it
Bull.
And not be that impressed. I think the closer you are to sport, the more you can spot the difference between an actor playing a cyclist and a cyclist. You can spot it a mile off. And, you know, the Graham O'Bree film was pretty good, but again, some of the cycling sequences in it for somebody who really knows the sport and knows what bike riders actually look like and knows what a bunch of riders looks like, there were bits of it that really, you know, you just had to look away for a few moments.
Well, I mean, I suppose as a student of ballet would say the same about
Absolutely.
Black Swan, yeah. But that doesn't mean that it's not an entertaining film for the general public that will open the door to a certain extent to the milieu of ballet.
But the problem is, as you say, it wouldn't be particularly positively received by a balletomane. But these days, millions of people watch the Tour de France on television, you know, and they know what it really looks like. So it's, I think it's very, very difficult to reproduce that.
People love sport, don't they? Because they love watching supremely talented, skilled practitioners. They enjoy watching the best in the world do what they're good at, whether it be the Football World Cup or the Tour de France. And so to see actors try to pull that off, it's quite a leap of the imagination to get beyond these aspects of their performance, I suppose, that will, and I think, inevitably jar a little.
I mean, I guess what you're trying to convey is perhaps not a reproduction of what you see on the television when you're watching something live or the evening highlights package, but you're trying to go and get this inside story that you maybe only can get a few years later.
And the human drama.
And the human drama of what's going on with these people, which I guess brings us, Richard, to your new book.
Oh, that was nicely done.
Yeah.
what a pro. Hoping to pick up a few tips today, Jack.
Well, you know, listen and learn, Richard. Etape. It's a collection of your tellings of the stages of the Tour de France that you consider to be the most interesting and revealing about the sport. I love it when books, a bit like Max Leonard's book about the Lanterne Rouge, the last man in the race, it seems like an obvious concept, but no one's done it before. So congrats on that. What gave you the idea to break down the Tour into stages over the Tour's entire history?
An editor gave me the idea. It wasn't my idea, and I was quite sceptical at first. I had to be convinced that it was a good idea, and the way I think that it proceeded for me was to make it quite personal. Selection, it's not the greatest stages of the Tour. They are literally just stages that are interesting, and that there's an interesting story attached to, but also, and crucially, to base each chapter around a new interview with the protagonist or protagonists. And there's a lot of, you know, sort of recycled Tour de France history, and a lot of the stories are very familiar. And so to make it fresh and to make it interesting for me, it was crucial to go out and meet the riders. Going all the way back, the earliest stages is Merckx in 71 and all the way up to David Miller in 2012. And, you know, some of the stages are tales of great stage victories. Some of them are tales of awful crashes. Some of them involve, you know, cheating, doping. Some of them involve weird team combines. One of them involves sort of looking at the Tour de France from the back of the race, you know, what it's like to be in the gruppetto, even struggling to stay in the gruppetto. So I want, you know, it's almost a virtual tour, 20 chapters, 20 stages, you know, with a selection of flat mountains, etc., a couple of time trials. So it's kind of virtual Tour de France, but also it isn't. And I think that what I wanted was for the chapters to work on their own, but also to be sort of interconnected. And inevitably, some of the characters, like Bernardino, for example, who's on the cover, he pops up in quite a few chapters, and in fact is even very influential in one stage that he wasn't even riding, for example. So, yeah, it's a sort of selection of odd, bizarre, great, interesting, scandalous stages.
And you are a journalist who writes about what happened on today's stage, but this is kind of a history view. They say journalism is the first draft of history. Do you feel that the stuff you're writing about in terms of what happened today, what happened yesterday, do you think that in 10 years' time you'll look back and talk to people and come up with a different story?
Definitely, because at the Tour de France, because the stages come so thick and fast and there's a new one every day, you will write the report of that stage that day, and literally the next day it's forgotten. I mean, it might be referenced again in your overall telling of the race, but really it's forgotten. And each day on the Tour, generally, you only hear the stories of two or three participants in the stage. You hear from the winner, you hear from the guy in the yellow jersey, maybe one or two other, the breakaway, one or two others. And so, you know, for example, to take one example, The story in 1998, the stage to Les Deux Alpes, which was won by Marco Pantani, which laid the foundations for his Tour de France victory. Bobby Julich was chasing him for a lot of that stage, starting up the final climb, and he believed he was riding into the yellow jersey, and he thought that was what was going to happen that day. It was a very dramatic day with terrible weather, Bobby Julich had an amazing story from that stage, but it wasn't one I don't think he'd ever actually told until I interviewed him for this book, you know, a few months ago. And that's kind of what happens. You know, there are so many, there are 190 stories a day at the Tour de France, and only a couple of them get told. And also with time, you know, Bobby Julich again, you know, now he can talk about the doping part of it, which he couldn't do a year ago. So there are things that happen. There's the perspective of time, that the fact that you're no longer, you've got the same teammates, rivals, etc. You can speak far more openly about what actually went on.
And have you found yourself contradicting or the contemporary record and finding out things that were said at the time that were not true? Because we do hear a little bit about things that were written at the time, particularly going back further into the mists of time before there was proper television coverage, that what was written in the newspaper was almost a fantasy and a fabrication to sell the newspapers.
There's one in particular, a stage from 1976, one by José Luis Viejo, a very obscure Spanish writer who didn't have an illustrious career at all, but he won the stage and he still holds the record for the biggest ever margin of victory, just over 22 minutes he won by on his own. And the story that was reported at the time was that he'd been allowed to go, that it was a deal to save his team that was struggling. And you know, going to interview him, according to him, that was absolute balderdash, that, you know, that wasn't what happened at all. And even the reports on the day of him being away in a break early on with a teammate were wrong, and there was loads of misreporting. And of course, it's still a challenging event to report on, because you don't see, it's not like it doesn't happen in an arena, you don't see everything that goes on. But in those days especially, I was following mainly the report by Geoffrey Nicholson in his great book, The Great Bike Race. And, you know, he talks in that book about stopping for coffee with his colleagues. So they actually missed a lot of the stage, and they were out of range of race radio for a while. So there was, especially back then, quite a large element of guesswork. And they would all agree what version of the story, version of the stage they were going to tell. So you can go back and you can definitely correct a few myths that have formed and survived over the years.
Well, let's turn to a stage of the Tour de France that Richard and I won't be able to shed much light on from being on the roadside, but Michael, you will. And this is when the Tour de France first came to Britain. There's a long feature by Ian Cleverly about the three times that the Tour has come to our shores. And the first one was in 1974, with actually another terrific picture here on the A38 in Plymouth. The story that Ian tells, which is really Barry Hoban's story, is that it was a complete disaster. From their arrival at an airbase and being held up in customs and locked in a cabin, the riders and all the entourages, to the final sprint in the stage, which had around about 200 metres from the line, which is not obviously ideal for a sprint finish. What's your recollection of that day, Michael?
Well, first of all, I'd rented a car in Portsmouth and driven down to Plymouth to watch it, and I really don't think it was worth it, because it was, I'd say in one word, boring. But it's a bit unfair, because there's more to it than as usual meets the eye. Poor old Barry Hoban, of course, was got all the blame, because the riders were all blaming him. He was the only, I think, English-speaking rider in the Tour. But actually, the real blame lies with Felix Levitin, the director of the Tour, who had a choice of routes in Devon. One was this dreadful bypass, which wasn't even open to traffic, which was why they used it. And the other one was apparently was a very exciting circuit of Dartmoor. And Alf Palmer, who was the organiser and is still around, still amongst us, said that it was Levitin's decision. So, you know, why did he make that decision? Maybe so that, you know, the Tour would hopefully never come back to the UK.
Surely not. I mean, they had no reason to come, did they? I mean, what was it? What was the reason for them coming?
There were two reasons. One was to promote the artichokes of Brittany, and the other one was to promote a new ferry service from Plymouth to, I think it was, Roscoff.
Oh, that's right, Brittany Ferries, yes.
Which was starting that year. But, you know, awareness and interest in bike racing, even the Tour, was so low in this country at that time that I don't think it achieved anything very much.
So they had them go up and down this bypass.
It was a circuit
five
of a
times.
Kind, yes.
I mean, that's a very strange thing to, for the Tour de France to do, isn't it?
Well, it's really interesting to learn that it was Levitin, the Tour itself, that demanded that, and because I think there's always been a perception here that it was the British not really getting what the Tour
Absolutely.
De France was all about. That's what people have always believed. So it's really that's an interesting revelation, really, that Levitin, and you get the sense that they were just wanting for it to be as incident-free and trouble-free and get it over with. I think the impetus for it came from the Brittany farmers, didn't it? There were commercial interests, but it was almost just like a box-ticking exercise, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes.
And then the next time the tour came was 20...
I was there for
years
that.
Years later.
Yeah, 94.
No, 20 years later.
Yeah.
Okay, so what are your recollections?
Oh, I came down to London to witness the tour's arrival in 94. And I can't remember where I went and watched it, but I went and stood at the side of the road, and it was a funny tour because Chris Boardman was riding his first tour, and he'd taken the yellow jersey in Lille in the prologue, and then he lost it in the team time trial the day before the tour came to England. And you would have thought, you know, that would have been a huge deal for Boardman to beat in yellow on British roads. And it's something that I remember Boardman telling me about, the team time trial, where his team, Crédit Agricole, they were at the time. No, GAN, apologies, they were GAN. On the morning of the team time trial, his teammates were riding around on their low-profile bikes with Allen keys, adjusting the saddles. They had not ridden, they weren't familiar with their time trial bikes. They hadn't ridden as a team. They hadn't prepared at all for the team time trial. So they were a bit of a disaster, and that was an opportunity lost. And then as soon as the tour went back to France, Sean Yates took the yellow jersey. So it was almost just while it was in Britain that... There was the Italian rider from the GBMG team, whose name escapes me at the moment, was in yellow when it was over here. Yeah. Teammate of Johan Museo.
Chris did try and redeem himself, because the first of the British stages finished in Brighton and I was at the finish line. And I think he sprinted for fourth place. And I think he says in the article that it was an effort on his part to at least redeem what he'd lost the day before, which was pretty sad, really.
He attacked on a spot of the road where young David Miller was standing watching the race, in fact. And David was quite impressed by that, left quite an impression on him. And Boardman had this reputation as a time trialist, as somebody who wasn't really a road racer. And for David, that reputation was at odds with his memory of him showing real panache and attacking in the stage.
And so would you put that visit down as a success?
Huge
yes,
success.
Yeah, I saw it both days, and I mean it was fantastic.
And with any lasting legacy?
I think probably it was extremely difficult for Alan Rushton to organise that, with going through the most busily trafficked part of southern England. And I think if it achieved one thing, possibly, it was that local authorities and so on began to understand what serious cycle racing meant and what it required. And then it moved on from then until the next visit.
I mean, the pictures here show pretty big crowds.
Crowds were enormous.
Don't they?
The crowds were enormous. Yeah. And there was a novelty aspect to it, whereas now the crowd is more knowledgeable and they understand it more. Mm. But there was great enthusiasm for it, and I got there was a real festival atmosphere.
Yeah. To the point where I just heard this morning on the Northern Regional News that they've now put an extra £2 million into crowd control for the tour in Yorkshire.
Well, they're going to need it.
They're going to need it, that's
quickly
for sure.
Through 2007, I'm told, through the eyes of Geraint Thomas, the youngest rider to start that year's race. I remember that. I remember both days, actually. I remember the prologue more for going out the night before after they just closed it off at about 4 in the morning, having been at the pub until shortly before then with a friend and we raced around and there was nobody else there, just us. And my friend crashed into the barriers and completely wrecked his bike did quite a lot of damage to his own self. And then riding out to watch it in Kent and seeing David Miller. And maybe he had a little bit of a thought of Chris Boardman. Thought that maybe he would inspire somebody on that day.
I think that's exactly right. And also Robert Miller, because he took the King of the Mountains jersey that day. So there was, it was certainly an attack that was sort of a nod towards Boardman and Miller and all the other writers who'd written, British writers who'd written the tour. He was putting on a show, basically, wasn't he?
This year, the tour in Yorkshire. I mean, what are the photos?
The tour's in Yorkshire.
What are the, as I said, Richard, you'll pick up a lot during this podcast with us. You know, take it all back to the cycling podcast and use it well.
I can't wait to tell them that the tour's starting in Yorkshire.
Yeah, they're going to love that.
At the risk of death by Twitter, I have to say that I'm afraid it's very unlikely that Mr. Cavendish will win first stage.
Controversial.
That's
he's going to win it.
If Sagan's on form,
Kittle
more like it. No, I don't think so.
No.
It's an evil finish, and it hasn't been written up at all. Although obviously, Cav has been aware of it. Funny story about Cav, by the way. He was wrecking recently the first stage, and his sat nav broke down, and two club cyclists came across him in a bus shelter in Leyburn, not knowing where to go. It's an evil finish, and I'm actually quoting Sid Barris on this. Sid thinks there's no chance at all for him.
Technical or...?
Very technical. Yeah. Where the trains are usually getting themselves in shape, it's quite a steep climb. Then you drop down quite steeply to the Royal Hall, and then it's only about, I think, probably 500 metres to the line. Most of it, quite a sharp little uphill.
Interesting. I didn't know that, actually. No. I hadn't really studied it in that, yeah, in that sort of
detail.
It's
going to be a very interesting finish.
Because certainly the script is for him to win that stage and take the yellow jersey, isn't it?
Well, of course it is. And the same, I really don't think he's going to pull it off.
Ruler magazine will be putting on an exhibition of photographs by the great cycling photographer Bernard Thompson, whose work often features in the magazine and in fact features in the current issue, the 1974 pictures, I think, from the tour in the southwest. The exhibition runs from June the 18th until June the 29th at the Riverhouse Art Centre, Manor Road, Walton-on-Thames, in Surrey. In Surrey? I thought it was in Yorkshire. Okay.
Surrey, Yorkshire.
Maybe Yorkshire can annex Surrey and kind of shake things up.
I don't think we better go down that road.
In fact, that can I just add something to that? That day, Sunday the 22nd of June, at the same place, Walton-on-Thames, the Riverhouse Art Centre, myself and a couple of colleagues are doing a talk, I think at 2 o'clock that day, part of the same thing with Lionel Burney and I think Ellis Bacon.
Okay,
so come along.
Well, and have you got any upcoming events you'd like to advertise, Michael?
No, but just talking of Bernard Thompson, he was an extraordinary character. He made his daily bread going out to time trials, taking photographs of every single rider, because we had numbers on. He knew which one was which, and then at the end, with our finishing sheet, we got a little receipt that said, if you want a picture of yourself in the whatever 50, you filled in and sent a postal order, and Bernard Thompson sent you the picture. And he actually made quite a good living at that, but was an extremely creative guy and did some wonderful photography, not just of time trials, as you can see from the Tour de France picture.
Are the photographs of, I'm just having a look here, because there's a feature at the back of the magazine about Dave Akam.
I enjoyed that. That's Andy McGrath again.
Yeah. But very interesting story.
That also is Bernard Thompson. Yeah. Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. David Akam is one of these forgotten British riders who, you know, rode alongside Francesco Moser in the 80s, including the Giro that he won in 1984. It's a fascinating story. And I think Andy's the expression is he slipped through the cracks of British cycling history. And it's good that he's gone and dug them out.
I mean, do you spend a lot of time peeking through the floorboards? Because that must be where, you know, the good stuff is.
Yeah, well, that guy I mentioned, José Luis Viejo, is another very obscure rider who disappeared. And yeah, there are others as well. Wilfried Nelissen features in my book, the rider who had a terrible crash in 94 in Armontier, when he hit a policeman who was taking a photograph. Oh. And Wilfried Nelissen, that was an awful crash. And then he had another one a couple of years later that ended his career. And he's one of the rare Belgians who's disappeared from the sport. Most of them stick around in some capacity. But he'd vanished, and he runs a courier company now. And weirdly, his job takes him to Armontier quite a lot. And every time he passes through there, he feels a kind of shiver. But he, as he put it, he said, There's nothing for me to forget because I can't remember anything.
God, that's it. Well, that's a terrifying but a great line. Speaking of what did they do next, we have a competition for a copy of Richard's book, Etap, which we've heard a lot about on the podcast, and I'm sure you're excited to read it. And if you answer this question correctly, then a copy will be sent to you as a prize, if you're the one that's pulled out of the hat.
Do you want me to ask the question?
Richard, yeah, because I can't remember what the question is.
Which 1989 Tour de France stage winner is now a sculptor?
That is a curveball.
I tried really hard not to mention him while I was talking about the book. So there are no clues earlier on.
Which 1989 stage winner is now a sculptor and a sculptor working, of some
working,
repute?
Working primarily in wood.
A wood-oriented sculptor. Send by email your answer to that to competition@ruler.cc, and we'll pick a winner out of those correct, that enormous avalanche of correct answers that there's going to be. But I guess someone could go to the bookshop, pick up a copy of Etap.
If they do that, I suggest just buying it.
Read it.
Just buy it.
Get the answer.
You're not allowed to open it and finger through the pages if you're not going to buy it. Okay. That's just rude.
Yeah. If you
Watterson's staff will be on the lookout for that.
we'll send out the memo now. So elsewhere in the issue, you can read about Pedro Delgado, Carlos Arribas, and Tim Kuhn taking the photographs, catching up with the winner of the 1988. Tour, Lawrence Ten Dam profile interview.
Can I just endorse that, because the Lawrence Ten Dam feature is, he's one of the most interesting current riders, and his story in this edition of Ruler is absolutely fascinating. I highly recommend it.
Guy Andrews has been over to Zip to look at their fast wheels, and you've got your usual columns from Matt Seaton, Johnny Green, and Robert Miller, as well as the latest instalment in Duncan Forbes' Brief History of Cycling Photography. So in a doormat flattening edition of Ruler, that's it. And that's it for the podcast. Michael Brecken, Richard Moore, thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Thanks for downloading this edition of the Ruler podcast. You can read Ruler magazine, which comes out 8 times a year, by taking out a subscription. Go to www.ruler.cc, or you can pick up the latest edition at a growing number of bookshops and bike shops. If you've got an iPad, you can read the magazine on the iPad, not only the current issue, but a handful of back issues as well. You'll find it in the Apple Bookstore.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.